embarking on a journey of taste and flavour this afternoon. We're going to be taking our taste buds on tour, and our guides for this international journey are two chefs who first came to the public's attention through the BBC programme MasterChef. Tim Anderson was the winner in 2011. His book is Nanban, Japanese Soul Food, and he's recently opened a restaurant in Brixton by the same name. Shalina Permalou, let's find your book, won the competition a year later, 2012. And her book is The Sunshine Diet. You can see I've got lots of bookmarks in this one. It's gorgeous. And the corners are turned down in this one as well, so I can highly recommend it. This is all about healthy eating and flavour, and thankfully not counting calories. So that's always a good start. So ladies and gentlemen, your World Flavours panel, Shalina and Tim.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Tim, let's start with you. You grew up in Wisconsin.
Yep.
And you were brought up on macaroni and cheese, mac and cheese, I think you say.
Mac and cheese, yeah.
Mac and cheese and sauerkraut.
Yeah, well, so we have a big Germanic influence and Scandinavian influence in Wisconsin. So I ate bratwurst and mac and cheese and Danish pastries and stuff like that growing up. But, yeah, I love that stuff, but I started to learn about Japanese food when I was a teenager, and it just sort of blew my mind,
And what attracted you to it in the first place?
There was a TV show. I was into Japanese pop culture in general as a teenager, the video games and J-pop and anime and stuff like that. So I already had that interest, but then also a TV show came on called Iron Chef, which was a Japanese cooking competition show. I don't even know why they started to show it in America, because it was really bizarre. But they did a British version as well, which was only on for one series. But everything about it was nothing like I'd seen before. The cooking, the ingredients, the whole setup of it was really theatrical. And I just saw it, and it was all dubbed over like an old kung fu movie as well. Like, it was kind of hilarious, but also the cooking was incredible. And, there were ingredients that I'd see and things done with them that I'd see that I'd never seen before, Things like, I saw seafood ice cream, sea urchin ice cream on this show long before I knew about Hess and Blumenthal. And, and things that now I find commonplace, like octopus and, foie gras, things that now as a chef and as an adult are not that interesting, but back then they were really crazy. So that's how it started, basically.
And then you began to study Japanese food.
Yeah, I went to college to study Japanese language and history, and I found that in studying history, I could study the food history, because there's a lot to it. And I got to do some research on Japanese food culture and got to go there for a month on a research grant to study. Originally, it was to study noodles and different regional variations, but it wound up being a project on local food museums in Japan. They're very very proud of their local foods in Japan, and so all cities and towns, they'll have museums dedicated to whatever they're very proud of. Soba, ramen, beer, sake, rice. There was a salt and tobacco museum in Tokyo. I still don't really know why. but yeah, that's what it wound up being about, because it was such an interesting phenomenon to me. And some of the museums are incredible. Like, they're really beautiful and interesting.
And how did you come to find out about this particular type of Japanese food? Because it's very specific, isn't it, Nanban?
Right. Well, I started to... I became obsessed with ramen noodles in broth, basically, when I was about 20, I think. I lived in Los Angeles, and there's a big Japanese community there. I would go out for Japanese food a lot and started to eat really good ramen there. Which, if you've had ramen, it's like pizza. It can be one of these things that's like... okay, always sort of acceptable, or it can be amazing, depending on how it's made. And the first time I had a really amazing bowl of ramen, I fell in love with it. And that led me to live, ultimately, in Kyushu, which is in the south of Japan. Do we have a map? You can kind of see it. It's the very last, the southernmost major island in Japan that's known for its ramen. I lived there, and when I got there, I discovered that the whole region is there's a lot more to it than just ramen, and so I became obsessed with exploring all the local specialties in that area. There's 7 prefectures. I made a point to travel to each one to see what was going on there. And that's what the book is about. It's about the food from the south of Japan, and food that's quite comforting and heartwarming. That's why, you know, you call it Japanese soul food. But the word nanban means southern barbarian, and it's what the Japanese called Europeans when they first arrived in Japan, because they would travel via the South China Seas, the Spice Islands, and arrive in the south. So the Japanese thought they were from the south, and they were barbaric. So that's what. So the other element of this book and the food that I cook is it's about Japanese food of foreign influence. Ramen, for example, is originally Chinese. There's a whole realm of Japanese food that comes from the Portuguese as well. Tempura is originally Portuguese. There's a dish called nanbanzuke, which is basically escabeche. There's a dish called chicken nanban, which is like fish and chips, but with chicken. It's delicious. So that's the other aspect of the book and the cooking I do. It's this Japanese food that's not really Japanese.
Let's move to you, Shalina. I'm not going to call you a southern barbarian, although you did grow up in Southampton.
Tell us about your softie, you can call me.
Tell us about your influences, excuse me, when you were growing up.
So it kind of actually isn't so exciting as Tim's. I was born in Southampton, so I'm from Hampshire originally, but both my parents came over from the Indian Ocean island of Mauritius. So growing up, I was from second generation. And all the food that we had growing up was essentially Mauritian. I first went to Mauritius when I was 12 years old. So I had 12 years of calling myself English. And then I turned 12 and I was like, I'm totally Mauritian. Like, I know about my roots now. The island is quite unique in the sense of its colonization. It was originally identified by the Arabs in the 1400s. And since had loads of different people travel through it. Because actually, on this map, it's in that door. So it's not on this map. That needs to get rectified. But yeah, basically, the winds are the reason why people would travel there. So when they take the ships, it would end up being a place where people would just end up. It was tropical island, volcanic island. So it had loads of lovely, lush vegetation. It's more green than you would imagine. But in terms of the food culture, it's Portuguese, French, Indian, African, and Chinese in its kind of melting pot of flavors. So it's a very unique food. The people are a mix and blend as well. So, you know, in different countries, I always get told I'm part of that country. So when I go to North Africa, they say I'm North African, Brazilian, Spanish, and I'm like, yeah, I'm one of yours. But it's because the bloods are mixed and there's lots of kind of Creole is what partly is what we speak, and also the culture as well. So I became obsessed with Mauritian food. My mum is a brilliant cook, so I was really, I fell in love with the food that she cooked. She's a very frugal cook, so everything was store cupboard, and I found it fascinating that she could just create incredible dishes with things out of a cupboard, you know, and a tin, using spices, and just incredible. But when I first went to Mauritius, I saw my first experience was coming off the plane and my hair basically turned into like Diana Ross from The Supremes. And
amazing.
It just went poof. And I was like, what is this? Humidity. The furthest I'd been before was France. So it was a big culture shock for me. And back then, it was very typical to see women in saris carrying grain and rice in woven baskets on their head. So that was my first experience of Mauritius. I stayed there for about 2 months. I don't actually think I think we did it in the school term because it was cheaper, so we just said I was sick or something. I'm sure that's what happened.
You wouldn't get away with that now.
Yeah, my mum would have got fined. But I loved it, fell in love with it. And actually, sort of my early years of travelling was mostly across England in a caravan. We were very poor, working class background, so we didn't have any availability to travel. But when I turned 16, I got quite excited about travel and basically traveled as far as I could, but my passion and my love for cuisine comes from Mauritius and the Indian Ocean.
And what were you doing when you were applying to MasterChef? What was your job?
Oh, crikey.
What possessed you?
I was always called like the big mama cook at university, so when anyone was hungry, they'd come to me and I'd cook them something. I could always whip something up like my mum could, so that's basically what happened. And then for about 10 years after that, everyone was like, you know, you should really do what you love, you should open your restaurant, have a cafe. I think it's quite hard because when you do a degree, you're kind of thinking you should stick into what you've done as your academic life.
What was your degree?
Psychology. So I went into equality and human rights, basically. So really out there. But I'm really passionate about changing the lives of people and making a difference to people who are from disadvantaged backgrounds. That's kind of what I love. And I kind of feel that food allows you to do that too. You know, through apprenticeship programs and things like that. But anyway, a random night, April 2011, my friend was like, hey, why don't you apply for MasterChef? So I did.
Because you saw me on it. It was so inspiring.
I remember watching Tim thinking, ooh, that looks good. But no, I was...
I was the same with Dhruv the year before me. I saw him win and I was like, that looks... I could do that.
Yeah, you know what? It's so funny because Dhruv and Tim and Matt Follis are so competitive. but I am like kind of not... I just wanted to cook. I think that's what it was. I didn't look at someone and think I could do better than you.
I'm not that competitive, though, and I always just... I don't know how it was in your series, but all of us were friends. We didn't feel like we were in competition with each other. We were, for me at least, and I think most of the other people, first of all, you're so focused on just doing your own thing that you can't really pay attention to what
Absolutely.
Other people are doing. And so I just tried to cook my best. I never thought I would win.
Yeah.
I didn't think I was the best cook in the room. But actually, I am competitive with Dhruv and Matt.
You are, definitely. Yeah. We do the Good Food shows, and them guys get, they're like, oh, it's 2-1. I'm going to win this time. And I'm like, when I first met Tim, Tim was like, I'm taking you down.
And
I was like, all right, Tim, nice to meet you. I actually won that first one.
Oh, whatever. Just who's counting? Who's so competitive now?
But no, it was quite a random thing. I just applied online and I genuinely never thought anything of it. I'm sure you
same
felt
here.
The same. And then about 3 months later, I got a phone call. Someone left a voicemail saying, hey, it's so-and-so from MasterChef. And I was like, is someone actually hoaxing me? and the process took about 2 months and then you're basically cooking for Baldy and John.
Yep.
So. Yeah, Greg and John, basically.
So if anybody here was thinking that they might like to try their hand, how terrifying is the whole experience or how wonderful is the whole experience? And think about it before you won. Think about what you were going through in the run-up.
It's, well, you're they're constantly throwing you into situations that you may or not be able to accomplish. Like, you're always in trouble on MasterChef. You're always in a stressful situation because you don't know what you're doing, especially in the challenges that are outside of the studio. In the studio, you can be a bit more prepared. It's a bit more controlled. But as soon as you're in another kitchen, then anything could happen. So it was always there was always that stress involved, but also you always kind of make it in the end. And I mainly have very fond memories of it because you get to have these amazing experiences and work with really great chefs and travel. I got to go to New York and work with Wiley Dufresne. You got to go to Thailand, right, and work with David Thompson.
Yeah.
I got to go to Australia. I really just mostly remember it as being fun and a great experience. So if you're thinking about applying, just do it.
And having been under that pressure, did that help you become more creative in the food that you were cooking in other scenarios?
Sometimes. I mean, one thing, when I started the competition, I was trying to cook Japanese food. But as soon as you get into the MasterChef studio and you have to do an invention test, you're limited in what ingredients are available to you. I didn't have any soy sauce. I didn't have any katsuobushi, kombu, miso, none of these things that would allow me to create like basic Japanese dishes. So I had to try something different, and it did make me more creative, and I wound up doing more sort of modern fusion type stuff. In most cases, I suppose it did force you to get more creative, weirdly, by being limited in what you had to work with.
I mean, I genuinely had no experience in what you would call the classics. So, for example, I didn't even know how to make mayonnaise before I went on the show. I knew how. I've watched someone make it, but I'd never made it myself. So I was very, very much more qualified in home style, you know, what I was being brought up cooking, you know, picking lentils and things like that. But to go and do sort of medium rare steaks, I found that challenging, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it forced me to think differently about how to take my Mauritian heritage, my food of my culture, and modernize it and turn it into something that could stand up next to the classics, what you would classify as the French, Italian, and Spanish, which are, you know, really and truly at the time, back then, Michelin stars were really focused on the European style of food. And now Japanese chefs, some of the most brilliant Japanese Michelin chefs
you'll
find.
The very first, there was a ramen shop in Tokyo that got a Michelin star this year.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's insane.
Excellent. So, yeah, I think that the climate has changed in terms of, you know, Tom Kerridge, for example, modernizing British food, taking frugal ingredients that we've always cooked and just pimping it up to the nth degree, turning into delicious food that's labored over. And that's kind of what I feel I'm trying to do with Mauritian food, and I'm sure you're trying to do with Japanese.
Oh, it's part of the territory. Yeah. We make broth at Nanban. It's... like some, it would be great to have a restaurant where you get great, beautiful like steaks and cook them lovely and make them beautiful. But we just get bones. Our butchery delivery comes in, it's bones, and we have to blanch them and get the blood out and chuck them in a pot. And 16 hours later, we have
it's
a lovely
all about
broth.
Flavor,
and
exactly.
it is kind of rewarding actually to take things that are almost not even edible.
Exactly,
when you
and
start
cheap.
Off with them. Yeah, and cheap, and then turn them into something good.
But no, I feel the same way. It forced me to be creative in that respect, forced me to think differently about food. I definitely cried a lot on the show, and I was terrified. So I do agree with what Tim's saying, that the actual experience forces you to get better and push yourself into places that you would never expect. But it is terrifying, so I'd say it is, and I did cry. For a long time, before, after, and when I get memories of John and Greg eating my food, I still kind of quiver.
Really?
Yeah, God, yeah.
You get those anxiety dreams still.
Yeah, even when we do like cook-offs and sometimes John and Greg have to be there and eat the food, I actually get nervous. Mm. I actually get anxious.
I got nervous in the beginning, but then I realized they're not such bad guys. I mean, they come across as that, but they're actually, I found them very supportive.
But I got nervous cooking for you for the first time.
Your food was great.
I wonder whether programs like MasterChef, as well as making the contestants more creative, have actually made the UK public a lot more creative and a lot more adventurous. What do you think?
I think MasterChef is good at sort of shining a light on food that's sort of new to the general public. Like, for you, Mauritian food. For me, Japanese food and molecular gastronomy. For Matt Follis, it was... the whole foraging thing that was happening, especially after Noma opened, and Simon Rogenthal, you know, super local food. I think that, you know, it's not like, I wouldn't say it's a trend-setting show, but I think that it does sort of expose the general public to new kinds of food that they may not have encountered before. Oh, and Ping, who won...
Malaysian.
Yeah, 2 years after you, last year. She does amazing Malaysian food, which is sort of on people's radar, but it was never given the airtime like that before.
And Dhruv with fusion.
Yeah.
And I think Dhruv was quite interesting at the time, because we had Thomasina Myers, who won in 2008 with Mexican kind of street food, and then for a while, nothing kind of... apart from Dhruv, he then brought in fusion. He's from quite an interesting background, Mexican, Spanish, Indian. So he had a really interesting kind of way of delivering food and bright colors, you know, and I remember that as well. And I very much remember Tim's year, because molecular gastronomy was not on something like MasterChef before. You were considered the science food man, and everyone remembers that, you know, with your
the
goggles
mad professor.
And the making your ice cream.
But that was... that was because I'd seen too many ice creams fail on MasterChef, and I knew liquid nitrogen
would be
would
the
get
only.
Me there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's talk about the ice cream actually in your book, because you call it Whippy-san.
Right. So I started doing Japanese soft serve ice cream at pop-ups 2 years ago, maybe 2.5 years ago, because in Japan, soft serve. Mr. Whippy, it's not just vanilla. They have amazing arrays of flavor. Green tea, purple sweet potato, you know, black sugar. I even saw a soy sauce one in Kyushu once. So I wanted to bring that here, doing Mr. Whippy with interesting Japanese flavors. And just, it's called soft cream in Japan, but Whippy-san for me.
So me, Mr. Whippy.
Yeah, exactly.
Would be the translation. Okay. And, I mean, you're really known for your fusion. I wonder if the audience agrees that actually with this sort of profusion of cooks and TV chefs and so on and so forth, you actually, if you want to follow that route, you have to go and get lots of different ingredients these days, don't you? And, you know, you need this for Nigella and you need this for... Da, 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 da. I'm going to put you on the spot. 5 ingredients that we would need to do the sort of cooking that are in your books?
Well, I have this actually as a chapter in my book, so it's easy. Soy sauce, Japanese soy sauce. Ignore the Chinese light and dark stuff. Not that it's all bad, but Japanese soy sauce is a different kind of flavor. Mirin, which is a sweet cooking sake, basically. Rice vinegar. But I can't remember now. Oh, miso. Miso will get you going on a lot of different recipes. And dashi in some form. You can buy dashi as a powder and reconstitute it. Dashi is a Japanese fish and seaweed stock or infusion. You can make it from scratch. You can get the ingredients, but they tend to be very expensive. And the powdered stuff is actually quite good. But those five will be what you need for almost any basic Japanese recipe. Most of the recipes in my book. But dashi is the one that all these ingredients are available at big supermarkets. Dashi is the only one you may not find at a big Sainsbury's, but you can get it at any Chinese grocer or online. Anytime anybody says, "Oh, I can't get the ingredients," I say, "You know, there's this thing called the internet where you can get literally anything you want. You could buy probably a tiger on the internet, so you can definitely get Japanese ingredients."
I had a little bit more time to think. I was like, So I'm going to cheat and say one thing, which is a combination of spices. So a Mauritian curry powder, which there is a section in my first book, which is how you'll know how to put it together. It's like a lighter masala. If you've ever had a West Indian curry, it's kind of similar to that, very light and fragrant. Shallots, thyme, coriander, and chili. That's kind of it, but you can get all of those ingredients in any supermarket. Yeah.
Okay, we're going to start with you this time. And so if there was a sort of threshold for people thinking, shall I have a go at that type of cuisine, what dish would you suggest, perhaps from your book, that they start with? What could people go home and pretty much cook tonight?
Have we got both books here? Yeah. So, sorry, it's a bit confusing. So my first book, which is Sunshine on a Plate, is all my Mauritian heritage food. The second book is my weight loss journey. I lost 3.5 stone, and it's basically an insight into world cuisine and using flavor and color to incite your taste buds to make you feel full so that you don't feel that you need to snack so much. So those are the two different books. I'll do Sunshine Diet because I think it's quite relevant. I reckon a green papaya salad would be probably where I would start. I just think it's so unique in the exploration of taste in the mouth. It covers all the senses, essentially. So you've got the sour, salty, chili, sweet, bitter. So it covers all of that. So I'd say, yeah, start off with a Thai green papaya salad. And you can get all of the ingredients in your local supermarket.
On the way home.
And if you can't get hold of green papaya, you can do something like zucchini, like courgette, with carrots and mix them up and have that together. But yeah.
Tim, I think the threshold with yours is potentially higher, isn't it?
Well, there's if anybody wants to cook ramen, which is sort of the centerpiece of the cookbook and my restaurant, that is something that is absolutely doable for anybody at home because the ingredients are really accessible. Like I said, it's bones. Butchers will often give them away. But that requires a weekend. It's a project, most of them, because the broth takes a long time and so do some of the toppings. They're not hard, but they're time-consuming. But I would say if you really want to, you could start with that. But if you want something quick and simple and crowd-pleasing and something that you can that doesn't have any ingredients that are hard to find, I would say karaage, Japanese fried chicken, which is really delicious. Everybody loves it. It's simple, it's cheap, and it's a great introduction to deep frying, which I think a lot of people don't do at home because they think it's unhealthy or dangerous, and it's not really any of those things if you do it properly. So I would say that one, it is our most popular small side dish at the restaurant, and everybody loves it. So I would go with that one.
Okay. So now after MasterChef, you talk about getting thrown into the food industry, sort of wholesale. So tell us about that and about your journey afterwards.
I think it's a really odd thing because I love food and I've always watched food programs. So all of a sudden you're at food fairs and, you know, you're saying hello to Mary Berry and Paul Hollywood, for example, when they become your mates or whatever. And I think that's a bit strange because you're, you know, on the other side. I'm not an actress. I'm not anyone who's worked in media before. So I found the media world a bit bizarre, you know, sort of going into that and publishing, learning about, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But I think having my family, that was the most important thing, making sure that I felt grounded throughout the process. But yeah, being thrown into the food industry, going to parties, eating lots of food, putting on a bit of weight. And then I wrote my book. So that was the main thing I wanted to do, was document my Mauritian heritage. So I wrote the first book in the first year and then the second book the following year. Writing for food magazines, having a relationship with Mauritius. I work with Four Seasons in Mauritius. So going back and having that relationship with the island is really good for me. It's kind of good for my soul. It makes me feel creative, and the colours and the food and everything. So yeah, the main thing is really setting up the restaurant, which I'm doing in the next few weeks, which is called La Case Mama, which means Mum's House in Creole. And it's going to be modern Mauritian street food. And it's coming to Southampton, hopefully in 3 weeks, if we manage to resolve the leaks
that
we're currently having on the roof. But yeah, 3-4 weeks, hopefully.
And has that always been a dream to set up a restaurant? I mean, in recent years?
Yeah, I think people expect kind of a very fine dining standard from MasterChef winners. So I do corporate fine dining and weddings and birthdays and all that. And I get to do all my poncy stuff with micro herbs and really fine dining crockery. But this food is what I love. Food I get messy with, food that reminds me of home, food that makes you feel full and happy. And I always envisaged having some little shack serving food from big pots and a big apron. You know, that was my dream, and that's what I'm getting. So it's going to be a kind of version of that, but hopefully with a roof that's not leaking.
And how different is that going to be to do all of those meals every evening compared to, you know, doing the stuff at home that you love in your kitchen? Are you a little bit nervous about that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I feel like I've actually lost the plot. I actually genuinely feel semi-unstable at the moment. But I've done lots of private events and I do lots of catering. So I know what I'm getting into. Tim will be better informed because he's sort of a year behind. You're a year ahead of me, essentially, aren't you?
Yeah, we are.
It's 4 months you've had your place in Brixton.
We've been open about 4 months, but we started the refit last April.
Okay, so now, so your place is called Nan Ban. It's on
Cold Harbour Lane in Brixton.
Okay, in Brixton. All right, so how's that journey been for you?
It's been intense. It's one you have to... you're constantly in some kind of crisis, at least for the first couple of months. And even 4 months in, there's fewer panicky moments. But every now and again, something goes wrong. You have staff problems with the building that are unresolved still. You know, the food's
landlords.
Good. And what's that?
Landlords.
Our landlord's quite good, actually. Okay. We're quite lucky with that. But it's great. I mean, it is... I remember saying to John Turode, you know, and everyone at MasterChef says they want to open a restaurant, or almost everybody, and he said, don't do it. Just flat out, don't do it. And I thought, oh, well, it's, you know, a bit of stress. But now, really, I understand, don't do it. Like, why would you do it? It's really, like, hard work and difficult, and it's risky. But I wouldn't... I'm so happy to have fulfilled the dream and to have it open and to have, you know, good reviews and happy customers. So it's all worth it. But it is one problem and disaster after another, at least for a little while.
So
you have to learn to enjoy that. And actually, just this week, we were down two people in the kitchen because one was off sick and one was a no-show. They just didn't show up. So it was three of us having to do a lunch service when there are usually five of us. And I was like... freaking out, like I was like, we're not gonna make it. And actually then we did, and it felt great. Like, and now I kind of live for that.
I live
for the moments where you think you're going to go down and you don't. And MasterChef was like that too.
I was gonna say, to be honest with you, I've only ever seen good reviews for Nan Ban, so that's coming from another perspective. So
we've had a few stinkers, but they're from idiots. So
what, people asking for freebies? I saw
that
one.
No.
Yeah, I mean, coming from the other perspective as well, genuinely had everyone in the food industry going, don't open a restaurant, just write books, make money commercially, write your books and just live a happy life. And I was like, but I really love the big pot cooking and that's what I want. And I agree. It's like a mini MasterChef moment. Every day there's a crisis and I haven't even opened yet. So give me 5 months and I'll probably be slightly bold.
We'll
talk
to you again.
Yeah. So interesting.
And how much have you had to change the menu, if you like, from what would be on a Tokyo street to make it enticing, really, to a London audience. I mean, I notice on the menu you've got electric eel, which is a kind of a note to Electric Avenue.
Well, we did a pop-up in Brixton last year, or 2 years ago now, and Brixton Market is just an amazing place. Like, the produce there and the amount of interesting ingredients you can find there, you know, West African dried smoked prawns, all kinds of spices, interesting vegetables. That was really cool to me. So I started doing a few dishes that would incorporate those ingredients and flavors. So we have a curry goat ramen on the menu. We have a ackee and saltfish croquettes. We do a salad that changes every day with just whatever looks good in the market. Stuff like that. So there's, and I always said, actually, when I was going to open a place, I would start with like the flavors from the south of Japan and those classic dishes, but I wouldn't want to limit myself and you know, I would like to try to be creative as well. And we're doing more and more of that. We're sort of saying, well, now we're established and people kind of know what we're doing. Now we can start playing around and having a bit more fun. So we're just, at this point, you know, not that I've abandoned the whole regional Japanese thing. There's still a lot of classic dishes on the menu, but we are adding more and more of our own inventions.
And what sort of a reaction have you got from Japanese people coming to eat there?
It divides the crowd because Japanese people all have their very favorite ramen shop in Japan that they remember and that they love. And if it's not like that, then they're not having it. So some people hate it. Some Japanese people, well, hate's a strong word. Some people just think it's kind of wrong. Some of them love it because it actually ticks that box for them. It reminds them of what they had back home.
So
they're the hardest people to please. To be honest though, it weirdly feels good when a Japanese person does like the food, but I don't. It doesn't have the opposite effect when they don't like it, because I am the same way when I go to other ramen shops in town. I think, well, here's how I would do it, or here's how I remember it, you know?
Okay. And in terms of authenticity, how authentic are you aiming to be with your street food, Mauritian street food?
I'm not as lucky in the sense that originally I wanted to open in London, so I was living in London for sort of 12 years, and I actually moved back to Southampton to be able to open the restaurant independently. So I've had to rein it in. I had all these visions of having, like, you know, crab curry and shells and big bowls and, you know, bibs, basically. Yeah. That would work well in London, but Southamptoners are very squeamish over, like, fried squid. So I've had to rein it in. The most adventurous I've been on the menu is I've introduced octopus. So, again, it's dividing the crowd because Southamptoners are not as adventurous with what they are prepared to eat. And it's going to be somewhere that, you know, it's an average price joint that people are going to want to come in often to. But when I do my fine dining, I get a lot of free rein. I'm able to play with so many things and flavors and combinations, which I love. I get such pleasure out of doing that. But again, I feel the same way. When a Mauritian person, an authentic elder, tells me they like my food, it literally makes me cry. I've done quite a lot of events, private events for Mauritians, and I'm more nervous about those events than anything else because I know they know what the food should taste like, but because I've modernized it, they're basically perplexed, you know, taking certain pickles and using them as garnishes. They're like, wow, that's really different and really delicious. So it's always a pleasure, yeah.
And your mum's going to be out the back in the kitchen, isn't she?
She is. She's a mean sous chef. Well, actually, in fact, that's probably wrong. She's a head chef, but in the kitchen, we're just going to have to pretend. But yeah, she makes about 150 samosas an hour. Who would not employ her? I have to take her on. And in Mauritius, weirdly enough, at the Four Seasons, on like a Tuesday, you see these like women come in, elder women. And I'm like to the head chef, and he's a 2-star Michelin chef. And I'm like, what are these women doing in these aunties? So they come and do the pickles. They come and make the breads. And they come to peel the pineapples, like the traditional way, because theirs tastes better.
What's the traditional way of peeling a pineapple?
Helter-skelter. And it takes a long time, and you have to master it with a machete. So if you get someone in the kitchen doing it, you're looking at probably 5 pineapples an hour. If you get the machete people, you're looking at probably around 30 an hour. So, you know,
Get your machete out. Okay. We're going to get the microphone out. So if anybody's got any questions, do you stick up your hand. Have we got a mic? Great. Hello. Anybody got any questions about MasterChef or flavours or things that they might fancy cooking this evening?
Can I ask a question just whilst people are ruminating? I'd like to know where the best place is to go to a market. Do I have to get up at 4 a.m. and go to Vauxhall to go to the old Covent Garden market?
You mean for wholesale?
For unusual ingredients. For those things that I haven't got time to Google and have them shipped to my door. But if you want a random herb or a flower to garnish something, where do you go? Where do you source your exciting ingredients?
I guess it depends on what kind of specific thing you're after, but I would say Chinatown has quite a good range of all kinds of things, and it covers a lot of ground, Chinatown. And then beyond that, if you can find places that have good veg markets that are still out on the street. Brixton is a good one. There's still one in Dalston. Green Lanes had one where I used to live.
Tooting's good.
Yeah, those places. I found a fresh callaloo in Brixton Market the other day. I've only ever seen that in cans.
What is that?
It's spinach.
Fresh.
It's like they use the word callaloo for actually a bunch of different kinds of plants, but the one I found was amaranth leaves, which tastes like a strong spinach charred flavor.
Slightly bitter.
Yeah, a little bit bitter, quite like punchy. And we turned it into a salad with Japanese mustard mayonnaise. I think whatever your local unusual ethnic market is, plus Chinatown.
Generic.
Well, yeah. Because each one of them has something
different.
They're so different. Yeah.
And will you source a lot of your restaurant food from markets in Southampton?
There's a few places. Again, quite quirky little kind of random Kurdish for certain pistachios. The Afghans do something different. Everyone's got something a bit unique. So, yeah, random ethnic conglomerate type places, global food type places, online as well for very specialist ingredients. I always find my micro herbs are better online. Certain sort of fine dining events, I use kind of very specialist herbs.
Sorry, that reminds me. One place that's really quite surprisingly good, if you don't mind the spend, is department store food halls. They have a very big range of unusual things.
That's true.
Selfridges sells micro herbs. Yeah. They sell great seafood and meat,
but
they also sell... They sell like marshmallow fluff there and Japanese craft beer. It's incredible.
Well, talking of the drinks that you're going to serve, or that you are serving, that you will be, have you imported Japanese beer and sake and so on, and you advise people what would go with particular meals?
Yeah, I've always been a beer geek, and I worked in the beer business before MasterChef, so the beer thing was always important to me. And we have some collaboration beers that we've done with different breweries. We've said, can you make us some beers with some interesting Japanese ingredients, and we've worked with them. So we've got those on the menu, and they're really good, and we've got a range of other, mostly British craft beers, actually, just because they're delicious and just... Not any reason, get them elsewhere. But we also specialize in shochu, which is a Japanese spirit. it's kind of like a vodka in terms of how it's made, but it's much less strong. It's only singly distilled, so it's in the 20-30% range. And depending on how it's made, it has an incredible range of flavors. So we're trying to put shochu on the map, and it's a tough sell because people don't know what it is, basically. Mm-hmm. But I'm convinced we're going to be ahead of the big shochu trend of 2019.
And what would be typical to have with the Mauritian meal?
Well, to be honest, I've focused so much on the food that I've allowed it to be bring your own. So a lot of the places in London that I like to eat are bring your own because it's so informal, and because it's mum's house, la casa mama, that's what would happen. So I would tell people to bring rum. We will, you've got soft drinks on at store. But rum, wine, whatever tickles your fancy, really. But we've got a load of sort of iced teas and traditional milk-type drinks, milk-based drinks, coconut milk and things like that. So
one thing that I noticed from both of your books, actually, is that both of the styles of cooking don't necessarily have starters and mains and desserts, because you talk about Nanban actually being a feast when it comes out, so all the things arrive at the same time.
It's true of a lot of food cultures where the food is served more like a banquet or what do they call it? The old distinction was Russian versus French service, where I don't remember which is which now, but one of them referred to the food being served in courses like we're used to now. That's what caught on in Europe. But I think in most of the rest of the world, that's not how it's done. It's everything is served sort of at once. Everybody, it's communal, it's shared. The sizes of the dishes range from little tiny bowls of pickles to huge, you know, whole fried fish and stuff like that. So, and some, you know, some people still don't really get that or like that. But for me, I enjoy it because I think it allows you to try more things that way. You can have, you can try six dishes instead of two or three that way.
And in your book, you talk about breakfast couscous, I think, is one of your recipes. So you're kind of mixing the ingredients. So we wouldn't necessarily think, oh, let's have couscous for breakfast, or I wouldn't personally. Do you think we need to get more adventurous with that side of things?
Yeah, I think particularly in the second book, Sunshine Diet, which is where that's found, it's more about thinking about food as fuel in that respect. So thinking about the things that will satisfy you. So that recipe you're talking about has got brown couscous, and it's really wholesome and filling. And people wouldn't ordinarily think of it as a breakfast, but it's so quick to make. You just add water, put it in a bowl, and all of a sudden your breakfast is ready. It's probably quicker than porridge. But in my first book, so the Mauritian style of eating is quite similar to what Tim's talking about. We have a thing called gajak. And gajak, if you can imagine, is like the Mauritian aperitivo where you would just have loads of things to eat with loads of drinks, and then you move on to mains. But there's no such thing as entrees. You know, that's very classically European. We don't have courses. You know, the Italian way of eating is everything is all about digestion, whereas Mauritians are greedy. And we're very hospitable and happy people, so we just like eating lots of food. So, yeah, I'm a fond believer that I get, like, food envy when I go to a restaurant. If someone's ordered something, I genuinely have to eat it. If I dine with someone that won't share their food, I'll never see them again. So,
that's a good rule for life, I think.
Yeah, just mean people, really. So, yeah, sharing is the way that I like to eat. So shove it all on the table and everyone gets involved, family style.
And finally, moving away from either Japanese or Mauritian, future trends within the food industry.
Mauritian, shoshu.
Specifically or generally?
What's out there that you're excited about, that, you know, you've got your fingers in the pies to know what we're likely to be eating in the next couple of years?
I think generally speaking, I think that people are going to... There's going to be more and more regional cooking that we see in the UK. We've already got it with a lot of different cuisines. You can find regional French, you can find regional Italian, Spanish, Indian, even Chinese now. I think we'll start to see more and more regional distinctions, like and American as well. We've already got great Southern American restaurants, but there's no reason why we couldn't have a Wisconsin restaurant. Because the more people learn about food, the more curious they become, and the more familiar they get with certain ingredients and flavors, then that allows them to get to the next step, basically. But specifically, I think there's going to be a congee trend. That's what I think. Chinese rice porridge, basically.
Okay, good.
I think across the UK, it's more food type specific. So, for example, you would say one of the biggest things at Nambam would be ramen, yeah? Mm. So I think that's the way that a lot of restaurants are moving in that direction, where they specialize in one thing and one thing that's very good, and, you know, offsprings of that one thing, if that makes sense. So, you know, you might just have like a roti hut that only specializes in rotis, but a variety of different ones.
Yeah.
So I think that's the way it's going. I also think raw food, even though it came sort of 6 years ago and then it disappeared, there are lots of people who are really kind of throwing out raw food is, you know, a big thing for last year particularly. But across Australia and America, they're doing some really interesting things with raw food. So I think that's another idea.
Julia, there's just a gentleman here with a burning question.
Where are you?
Just over here. Okay. Sorry, as a roving reporter over here.
Hello, sorry. I'm a Mauritian like you, Selena.
I can tell by your accent.
Yeah, and I think I can cook. My wife will testify to that. The question is, all my sisters, my mother, all my aunties, in Mauritius, only the women who do the cooking, by the way, tend to, they all cook without a recipe. Could you tell me where the recipes are made as an invention for you guys to make money?
Interesting. So I learned in the same way. So it was all through my mum and my auntie. And I think traditionally, the way that the Mauritian setup was, and a lot of West, you know, non-kind of Western cultures, people learn in the kitchen by their parents, essentially. So in terms of the recipe, what I found is actually by writing a recipe book, a lot of Mauritians are buying it, particularly Mauritian women, because of the breakdown of the old school cultures where you would live with your mother-in-law or your mother-in-law lives next door or you're living very close to your family. Everyone's a bit more disenfranchised in terms of the community. So I have loads of women who are newlyweds needing to cook for their greedy husbands and wanting to learn how to cook traditional recipes. So I had to write recipes down, which I found really hard. I mean, a pinch of salt, what does that mean to everyone? 2 grains of salt? What does it mean? 1/2 teaspoon? Does it mean 1 tablespoon? So a pinch of salt is so hard. And to have my aunties go, just a little bit. And I'm like, how much is a little bit? They're like, little bit. And I'm like, right, okay, we're going to need to measure this. So recipes are important, I think. And to write recipes and to keep them as part of the repertoire of the culture, I think, is so important. Because, you know, it's so easy to lose those things. And to maintain your heritage and culture is really important. At least it was for me.
Thank you very much. Thank you for that question. Thank you very much to you for coming. Shalina and Tim are going to be over at the Stanford signing desks, and the books are over there as well if you'd like to go and pick one up and carry on the conversation. But thank you very much, Tim and Shalina, and the World Flavors panel.
Thank you.